This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Needs No Introduction, fresh ideas from speakers of note. I'm Victoria Fenner. Classes are ending and college and university students are putting away the books. It's been a difficult year this year as students, faculty, and administration of several university campuses have had to deal with issues related to sexual violence on campus. St. Mary's University and Dalhousie University are this past school year's examples, but we've seen other incidents at other campuses too in the past few years. Add that to this winter's arrest of Gian Gomeshi on sexually related violence, and we're hearing a heightened level of discussion about the issue to an extent that we've never heard before. And while hearing about these incidents is horrifying and disturbing, the fact that we're now talking about them is a good thing. Today's Needs No Introduction is from a discussion held at Carleton University earlier this semester. The guest speaker was Sue Montgomery, who, along with fellow journalist Antonio Zerbesius, created the Been Raped, Never Reported hashtag. They were surprised by how quickly it took off. Many people, Sue says, don't realize how widespread and normalized sexual assault is, even in a country like Canada. In her presentation, Sue Montgomery talked about her own experience as a victim of sexual violence, the role of media in covering sexual assault, and the importance of these conversations in helping victims of sexual assault recover from their experiences. Here now is Sue Montgomery.
So thanks for coming out to this, and probably a lot of things that I'll be saying, I'm probably preaching to the converted, unfortunately. That's always seems to, the way it is. It's too bad we don't have some guys here. But maybe you can tell your guy friends what they've missed. So I assume a lot of you know about the hashtag or what happened last fall in the wake of the Gian Gomeshi sexual assault allegations. I remember it clearly. It was Sunday night, and I had heard all these rumors about this guy because I'm in the media, and I had seen the post that somebody had put on Facebook anonymously saying she had had this bad date with this radio personality. So everybody knew that it was Gomeshi, but you know, because of libel laws and defamation, nobody could come out and say it. So on Sunday, when they said he was fired from the CBC, I thought, okay, CBC does not fire people lightly, especially their biggest star. Something's up. And then I saw his Facebook, he doth protest too much, like the classic, you know, it's a jilted lover. Hello. Not very original. And then, or had he been suspended and then he posted that and then he was fired. Anyway, and then the Toronto Star came out with their story right away. So it was all in one night, bang, bang, bang. And I was up on like watching all this and my husband's like, are you going to bed? And I said, no, like, are you kidding? Like, this is a meltdown happening. So I stayed up and read all of it. And then I was glued to the story all week and very sad that, oh, sorry, I'm just going to turn off my phone. Sad that I couldn't actually report on it. You know, it was a fantastic story. It was kind of like the Rob Ford story that I was having story envy. And so I was watching it, and then I was watching on social media that everybody's saying, you know, why don't these women come forward? Why don't they go to the police? Why don't they give their names? Why are they anonymous? And I was getting increasingly angry because I knew why they don't go to the police. None of us go to the police. None of us tell anyone. We all keep it quiet because we think it's our fault, or we're afraid we'll lose our jobs, or we're afraid we'll screw up our families, or for whatever reason. So I started thinking, like, can you imagine if there was a list of all the women in that situation who had been sexually assaulted and did nothing about it in terms of going to police or telling somebody? Like, that list would stretch around the world easily. So I went to work that day, and I was still obsessed with this story. And there were all these discussions going on Facebook, which I found very interesting because guys that I consider progressive and, you know, feminist, supportive, they were all shocked to hear that, you know, it's our daily routine to be flashed. It's daily to have some guy jerking off and on the bus or whatever. Like, we just live with it. And they were kind of like, really? Like, they're a bit in shock by this. So then I realized, like, they really, we don't talk about it enough. Because if my friends that are progressive and supportive don't know about this, there's a problem. So anyway, I sent Antonia Zerbisius, who was, it was her second last day to work for work. She was retiring from the Toronto Star, and we've never met each other. We've always sort of conspired as, you know, on social, the beauty of social media. And we didn't know each other had been raped. So I sent her a message and I just said, you know, let's create a list of all the women who've been raped and never reported it. She said, okay, I'm just running out now. How do you want to do it? Facebook, Twitter? I said, I don't care. We have to do something. So she came back with this hashtag. How about this? Been raped, never reported. I said, great. I wrote mine, put the hashtag on, hit send, went out. She did hers. And seriously, it was like a 2 minute, maybe 5 minute max going back and forth. And the thing just took off on fire around the world. People who count these things and keep track of them and know how to add these things up told me that it was used 8 million times. That's the last I heard. I was on, but I think that's with retweets and, you know, everything. So I was on BBC two or three times, once in a conversation with women, a woman from India, a woman from Pakistan, a woman from Kenya, like we were all hooked up on the same show. And they just said, we're shocked that we thought women in Canada were equal and were supported in the justice system. And for sure, we're better off than most women in India or say, Pakistan. But still, it was a shock for them to learn that this kind of thing goes on. Like, the men in Canada get away with this every day. So it was a very busy fall, because at the same time I was covering the Luca Magnotta murder trial. So during the breaks of this awful murder trial where the guy cut up a Chinese student, I was giving interviews and talking to people in French and English. Like, I was just amazed at how 140 characters just took off. It was exhilarating. It was exciting. I thought, oh my God, this is such a powerful tool to empower women, to bring women together. Like, all these women just felt like they were no longer alone. Like, they weren't crazy. And, you know, they just felt this sisterhood. And one of the things I noticed was the trolls were quiet. And, you know, we all know how nasty it can be on the internet, but nobody said. I tweeted, I think, two or three tweets about my different experiences with sexual assault, and not one troll attacked me. So I kind of got this feeling like, wow, we've really stared down. Like, I think they're afraid. I think they're really afraid of being outed or reported, and if we can go after someone, an icon like Gomeshi, we can go after anyone. So I felt this incredible power because of it. So just briefly, my story is that I was sexually assaulted by my grandfather from the age of probably starting around 3 to about 9. And then when I was in my early 20s, I worked for Air Canada as a flight attendant. And on a layover in Frankfurt, an older, more senior flight attendant raped me. The routine back then was, you know, there was like zero. This was pre-9/11. There was no security at all on planes. So we used to take beer off the planes on our layovers. And he said, you know, I have beer. Who wants to go for a beer? Of course, I said, you know, yeah, sure. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. Why not? I've been working all night. So he said, great, I'll come to your room. He came to my hotel room and he attacked me. I didn't know what to do. I thought, I'm in a strange country. I'm working for the summer. If I report him, I seriously thought I would lose my job. And I don't think that's an unusual thought that goes through people's heads. Women are harassed, assaulted daily in their jobs. And because men hold the power, they get away with it. So that's briefly, and as for my grandfather, I tried to go to the police in my 20s, and they just said to me, why are you coming to us now? And I said, well, because I was three and could barely talk. So, you know, excuse me for waiting till I was an adult. But that was really hard at first because it created a huge explosion in my family. It turned out that my grandfather was also abusing my sister and my cousin and my grandfather, or my uncle, my grandfather's son, my dad's brother, was abusing them, two of those girls at the same time. Like, they were a little tag team. And there were God knows how many other girls because my aunt used to babysit in their home. So the police did nothing. And my uncle is still living in Chatham, Ontario. If you'd like his address, I'd gladly give it to you. So with the way I dealt with that was I took it into my own hands. I went to my grandfather's house when he was obviously still alive and confronted him. And I said, this is what you did to me. I remember this, this, and this. He called me a liar. And I said, whatever, call me whatever you want. And he was religious, as many of these guys are. And I just said, you know, God knows what you did, and, you know, I know what you did, so you'll rot in hell, basically. And I walked out, and it was the best feeling ever. And I never saw him again except at his funeral. And all these people were at the funeral, and they couldn't understand why my sister and I were, like, sitting at the back laughing and chatting and super happy. And we put this ad in the local paper, I don't know, quotation from the Bible about harming children, you know, and people thought that's a weird thing to have in someone's obituary. But anyway, put two and two together. So, you know, there's different ways of getting back at these guys without actually going to the police if you don't want to go that route. And I highly recommend them. So my big concern now is after this hashtag, you know, exploded and trended and whatevered. What do we do now? Like, how do we keep this discussion going? You know, the best way, you may have noticed at a party, to clear the room is to bring up sexual assault, right? Like, people, I don't want to hear about it. And in my job as a journalist, I'm a court reporter, so I've covered a lot of sexual assault or and especially sexual abuse of children trials. And people will write to me or talk to me and say, well, I saw your article, but I didn't read it. I just can't read those things. It's just too awful. And I say to them, you have to read it. It's not going to go away by pretending it's not happening. We owe it to these victims to at least read what their experience was. You can't bury your head in the sand about what's going on, and it's not going to stop, and it's not going to go away. So somehow we have to make sexual assault or sexual violence, you know, a fun topic somehow. I don't know how we're going to do that, but and I think I'm very happy to see what's happening in the province with Wynne's, what's her first name, Catherine? Kathleen. Kathleen Wynne's, you know, updating the curriculum on sexual sex education. I think that is paramount. I think we have to have sex education from day one. It's not going to turn them into, what would that woman say, little homosexual minions and lesbian minions or something. It's like, okay, well, worse things could happen, actually. And because my son, who's 16, came home from school the other day, he said, Mom, we had sex education today. You're not going to believe this. They said, basically, if we have sex, we're either going to get pregnant, and this is a 16-year-old who's probably already having sex. We're either going to get pregnant or we're going to get STDs. And then we had to put on these glasses, the beer goggles, and imagine putting on a condom with these beer goggles on. It just was like, are you kidding me? Like, that's your sex education? That's ridiculous, beyond ridiculous. Oh, no, you got to imagine, not going to touch your penis, that leads to masturbation, come on, I don't want that. So that's, I mean, I think we really need to push education. We need to teach kids what constitutes, you know, a healthy, respectful, equal relationship. My husband runs an NGO in Montreal called Equitas, and they do have a thing called Play It Fair, where they go into schools and summer camps, and they teach kids about their rights, and they teach kids what it feels like to be excluded. They play musical chairs with them, but opposite, so that somehow they have to figure out how to get everyone on the last remaining chair rather than, you know, competing for the last remaining chair. And I think we need to be doing more and more exercises like that. Like, if we could show men what it feels like to be sexually assaulted. I don't know how you do that, but let's say you could role play somehow. And of course, men are sexually assaulted, of course, but I think the large majority don't even know that when they make a sexist joke or when they grab your ass or when they catcall you or whatever, what they're doing, you know, what it feels like. So somehow we have to be able to transport those feelings into guys so that they get what it does to us, like create empathy, you know? Because they have to be part, I mean, it's their problem. You know, they have to be part of the solution. It's not our problem. And we also need, like, specific tools in the workplace. A lot of workplaces I've been in have a sexual harassment poster on the wall. But who reads that? And, like, what does it mean exactly? So I think when you get a job, the person hiring you should say, you know, this is what we will not tolerate in this workplace. This is the kind of, this is what sexual harassment looks like. And if you experience this kind of behavior, this is the person you go and talk to. This is how you deal with it. You need specific, you know, steps to go through if you either commit the crime or you are a victim of the crime. And also tools for, like, I have an 18-year-old daughter. So I always try to give her tools to get out of the situation, because often as women, you know, we don't want to embarrass people, we don't want to create a scene at parties, or, you know, so we need ways to leave these situations with our dignity intact, you know. So a lot of it comes down to confidence, which is really not something you can't teach, but it's very empowering when you start standing up to these guys and telling them how they make you feel. And I'm also very concerned about what's happening on the internet. It's a fantastic thing, the internet. I grew up without it, believe it or not. There are people who have not ever had the internet. And your generation is the first, I think, to have grown up. The internet started, what, 95? So you guys were probably born around then-ish. So you have grown up. Well, you know what I mean. You've had the internet all your life, basically, more or less, as you can remember, right? Can you remember not having it, you know? So the thing is, this takes me back to sex education, that my kids both have their smartphones, and God knows what they're Googling, you know? It terrifies me sometimes what pops up on my computer screen without even asking, like, what is this? So instead of getting sex education, they can just Google whatever they want, and that's how they get their education. So they get this porn where some guy is basically sexually assaulting a woman, and she's pretending to or acting like this is enjoyable, and they get this idea that that is a normal relationship. Well, it's not. You know, and that is the link that kids are missing, I think. And, you know, my daughter tells me stories where I try to not react, like, with horror. But it shocks me how some men behave, and some men, how they treat her, what they ask of her. Luckily, she's confident enough and aware of herself enough to walk away from it. But I worry that one day she'll be in a situation that she won't be able to walk away from or get out of. I don't know if you guys saw the Toronto Star report last fall about the Canadian universities. There's only 9 of 78 Canadian universities that actually have created a special sexual assault policy. Now, this comes from the Toronto Star, so I haven't checked their reporting, you know, double-checked it if it's accurate, but I assume that it's, you know, I assume they did their research. None of the 24 colleges surveyed in Ontario have a sexual assault policy, and some of the universities without a policy are the big ones: U of T, McGill, UBC, Queen's, Lakehead University, and Thunder Bay created one in the wake of a student sexual assault. 9 universities with special policies are Lakehead, University of Guelph, Brock, St. Mary's, Acadia, St. Francois Xavier, St. Thomas, and Mount Allison. I'm happy to hear Mount Allison because that's where my daughter's going in the fall. And Western. I don't know if Carleton has one. And U of O, we know what's happened there. And then I've covered a couple of incidents at McGill. One most notably of 3 football players that took a young woman home to their apartment. Well, and she believes that she was drugged, and they assaulted her. The next day she went to her resident, her dorm advisor, told her mother, told her sister. Eventually they went to the police. Eventually the 3 football players were charged. And when I found out about it, I called McGill and I said, you know, why didn't you do something about this before? And they said, well, the student wasn't from our campus. I was like, okay, but the alleged rapists are, and they are on your football team, and they are still on your football team. So it wasn't until it got into the media that they were suspended, and so it came to court around the Gomeshi time, and this resident advisor, the Crown had been getting her trying to get her to come and testify. She didn't want to get involved, if you can believe it. And she didn't want to get involved. Finally, they had to subpoena her, which is something you don't want to do. You don't really want to force a witness to come. You want someone to come on their own accord so that they're not a hostile witness. So they subpoenaed her, and she sent them an email on the Friday before it was to come to court on the Monday, and basically said, she came to my room and told me it was consensual. So imagine you have been out one night, you've had sex, this great sex apparently, with football players. So the first thing you're going to do is go to your resident advisor the next morning, knock on her door and say, hey, listen, I just had consensual sex. Like, as if. As if. So anyway, the Crown withdrew the charges without even putting this witness on the stand. It's outrageous. The woman is devastated. She's a student at U of O now. I stay in touch with her. We're trying to figure out how she can somehow get these charges reinstated. Because at the end of the day, nobody is better off in this situation. A cloud still hangs over these football players. Okay, the charges were dropped, but that's not the same as a not guilty verdict, right? So some people believe, you know, perhaps they're guilty, and a cloud still hangs over this young woman. Did she make it up? So at least in court we could get to some version of the truth, but that didn't happen. So in the wake of all this hashtag, I received all kinds of messages privately and so on from people who weren't ready to go public but were thanking me for doing it. And like I said, I mean, that's not why I did it, really. I did it because I was angry and I'm impulsive. And I just wanted to say, look, you know, stop attacking these poor women, these poor victims of Gomeshi, and start attacking the person who should be attacked, which is Gomeshi. So, but one of the most heartbreaking ones was from a father whose daughter was at university and was attacked. He said, it affected me like a sledgehammer to the chest. It was always someone else's story, but today it was mine. My daughter left for university last September, first year at Memorial. It had always been my daughter's dream to go there. Last month at a party, she was raped. Too drunk to stand, and a group of boys took her to a room and raped her. They admitted they performed a sexual act. My daughter was witnessed staggering in the halls. Police were called. They just finished their investigation. They believed the boys and have just closed the investigation. Now she has to submit a complaint to the university. They have all but told her that she has no chance. It's no wonder that women stay quiet. The university admits they are dealing with many of the same stories. She fears now that these boys will be in her classes and at the cafeteria. I don't know what to tell her. This is a club that I never wanted to be in, a father of a raped child. So, you know, I mean, with a, as a parent whose daughter is about to go off to university, this particular message really struck home for me. So, and I'm very worried about what's going on in universities. I think there's always been this sort of culture where you go off to university and you're on your own for the first time, and you know, you tend to get a bit, I mean, you go a bit crazy, right? Like, it's fun. But it seems to me, and with the case of the Dalhousie dentist students setting up that Facebook page and saying those horrible, like, I just can't believe that they haven't been kicked out of school, and instead they're being taught separate from everybody else. Like, how is that a punishment? I think we have a long way to go. In many ways, I think we've actually gone backwards. So I just hope that your generation, I can't believe I'm talking like that, like I'm an old lady, but I am. You know, we just have to continue this fight and this speaking out and standing up and somehow including men in the discussion. You know, you have to bring your friends to these things, because we can't do it alone. Like, it can't be just one gender that does this. You know, it has to be everyone. And it just basically comes down to respect. So that's basically all I have to say. I like to leave some time for questions because, you know, otherwise you fall asleep. So if you want to ask anything, go ahead.
Thank you so much for that. My name is Erin Lamb with the Ottawa Coalition to End Violence Against Women. And I think what we've seen is a really powerful allyship with journalists on exposing sexual violence. And we have a media hub which provides tips for journalists on sensitively reporting on gender-based violence and violence against women. And I'd really like to hear from you about that relationship, especially in the face of what's perceived of what's objective reporting.
Well, I think it's interesting because I've seen a shift in the way we've covered it too. And I think the reason there's been a shift is as the industry, journalism, goes down and there's fewer well-paid jobs, that more women are in the job, sadly. That's reality. All my bosses now are women. All the management at the Gazette are women. I don't think that's ever happened. You know, it used to be a male domain solely because it was well-paid and it was a prestigious job. Now it's going down the tubes, so men don't want to do it anymore, so who gets, not that the management we have now, these women are fantastic. They're the best bosses I've ever had. Partly because they get things like sexual assault. They get these issues that we've been banging our heads, you know, trying to get into the paper in a sensitive way for years, all our lives, or all our careers. Sadly, I think that's the reason that it's changing, which, I mean, it's good that it is changing, but not necessarily the reason that it is. And I think, too, I like to think that the male journalists that are working now are more sensitive too. I mean, you know, it's not the stereotypical guys with the bottle of scotch in their drawers, you know. And I think also it's, as a journalist, it's very difficult thing to cover because of the confidentiality around it. I find that a lot of times when I call a sexual assault center or like a shelter or whatever, it's better now because they know me, but they're very, very wary about, and understandably. But the thing is, as a journalist, you need people to tell stories. So you don't want to just talk about statistics. You don't want just the organization's line. You know, you want a woman or a man to tell you what they've been through. And by law, we are not allowed to use the name of a sexual assault victim. We're not allowed. That's the law. The woman or the man can go to court and ask the judge to lift that publication ban. I've seen that happen because a lot of women and men think, I have nothing to hide. Like, what? Why should I be ashamed? Why can't my name be out there? And I find it interesting because if I cover, which I did this week, there was a case where a man had sexually abused his daughter from the age of 10 to 16 and then got her to bring friends home for him to abuse, four friends. But I couldn't name him because by naming him, I identify her. But I always like to get the perpetrator's name in the paper because more times than not, there are more victims who will come forward once they see the name in the paper. So I always try to do that. But one way I can get around that is by saying he abused five children without saying one is his daughter. I thought in this situation, it was better to, because he had used his daughter to bring the other girls home, I thought that was an important element of the story. So I had to make that decision. But some of us, and like some of my colleagues and I in the other papers, we said, okay, you tell the story this way, you use his name, I'll tell it this way without his name. People can put two and two together, you know, because we're not all, we're all bound by the same rules, but there's no cross, you know what I mean? Like we can follow which rule we want. Yeah, so I think what we need to do as journalists and for people who work with in the area of sexual violence is, you know, create those relationships, trusting relationships, so that we can have people tell their stories. And you have to understand that we would never use their names and that we would never use any details that may be able to identify them. We're not allowed.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Lomatsky from the Sexual Assault Network. Just to go off of Aaron's point, I think it's always this like fine balance for us between critiquing media when they need to be critiqued and then also collaborating. And we sometimes find that when we critique, then that collaboration kind of goes down. I'm wondering if you can kind of speak to how.
Well, I think every medium is different. You know, TV needs the visuals and the sensational and the whatever. And radio, which is my favorite medium, although my prof here at Carleton said in my evaluation, probably better off in print. So I never went into radio. You know, so each medium needs different things. Print, I like because you can talk to the person and eventually they forget that they're talking to a journalist. You know, you don't have a mic in their face, you don't have a camera in their face. You can put a person at ease to tell their story. I think probably the best thing to do, if you can, is to foster a relationship with a journalist. Like, find the journalist who is interested in the subject and then create that relationship so that when they're doing a story on this issue, they will turn to you for comment. Does that make sense? But to criticize, there's nothing wrong. I mean, I get, you know, I like it when readers write to me. That they do less and less because I think people don't read the paper anymore. But I like it when someone actually reads the story and has something to say. And I don't, you know, journalists have pretty tough skin. Like, I think you can criticize in a respectful way, you know, there's nothing wrong with engaging in debate of how things should be covered, you know. I mean, I was always open to that with people that I wrote about, except politicians. But, you know, like, we're not, I think for the most part, we're not, like, we're human beings too and sensitive to things. So, I don't think journalists want to hurt people any more than they've been hurt. But I don't know, like, can you think of a specific...
I think one of the most recent cases, and it's this subtlety, right? So if we're looking for like a cultural shift, sometimes for the hockey team, Olympique, that in some of the reporting, it was very much like very kind of factual. But then she was seen stumbling, whatever it might be, kissing other people. And it almost as if really takes away everything. And I think in a very subtle way that people don't always kind of realize, in the back of their mind creates that bias of, well, she was doing X, Y, Z, so maybe, right, the onus is on the different person. And, like, part of it, I think, appears factual in saying, like, this is how she would, but in even putting that, it's almost the same as saying, what was she wearing, right?
And
yeah, and so you want to critique that piece, and at the same time, still want to foster that relationship. And I guess it's more that it's always that conflicting place, right? But
Carolyn Johnston, coordinator of sexual assault services at Carleton. So many questions. But just going back to the last thing you said, so I think it was Rolling Stone that published a lengthy piece. And then there was lots of questions about it. And if I'm not mistaken, the magazine basically threw the young woman under the bus who'd come forward. So I guess I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts on that. And then, you know, obviously that can cause a lot of damage about other people coming forward in the future. So I'm just wondering what your thinking is about that situation.
Well, for sure it's a very tricky subject to write about because... Like, people always say, well, you know, it's her father. Why would her father do that? Well, we all know fathers do that, or some fathers, and it happens. You know, I don't know anyone who has, like, why would anyone make this up? Like, this woman at McGill she left McGill, she was on sick leave, she switched universities, her whole life was thrown into disarray. So, really? You're going to make it up to destroy your... Like, it makes no sense. It makes no sense whatsoever. So, and at the same time, there's this balancing act of protecting the rights of the accused, right? So how do you give that person a fair trial? Because we all have a right to a fair trial, no matter how heinous the crime is. That's our system. And I'm glad we have that system. But it's a very delicate, it's a very difficult line to walk. Now, in terms of that story, the Rolling Stone, unfortunately, I don't know enough details about it. But I think it's unfortunate that it happened because I think it reflected very badly on the journalist. I think it reflected badly on Rolling Stone. Like, there was some editing, like, editors should have done their fact-checking there. But like I said, I think what you need to do is build a relationship with a journalist. You know, I've been doing it for 30 years. I get a lot of women coming to me with their stories. I don't always report them because for various reasons. I especially don't get involved in custody cases and family law cases. It's just like... It's he said, she said, you cannot, you don't know what's going on. And I just, you know, you do one of those, you're going to have 100 people calling you. So, but definitely because sexual violence is a crime, it needs to be reported and it needs to be dealt with. So I'm sorry, I'm not really answering the question.
Can I have a different one?
Okay.
That's okay. Yeah.
So obviously, you know, a lot of women don't report, you know, a lot of the reasons behind reporting. But you also are a justice reporter and cover criminal justice issues. So what, from your perspective, needs to change in the criminal justice system if we want women to come forward or at least be open to exploring reporting?
Most of the cases I cover for sexual assault are the very violent ones that are committed by strangers. The guy breaks into the house, attacks the woman, and then leaves, and then he's arrested, and eventually he's charged, and usually it's not his first offense, and he's declared a dangerous offender eventually. Those are the ones. Then the other ones I see less so are like women who, years after being sexually abused by a grandfather, uncle, father, whatever, come forward. I'm seeing more and more of those, which I'm encouraged by. Very difficult to prosecute. Many times because the guy is too old to actually live to see his trial date. But I think, I don't know about the rest of Canada, but I think in Quebec, it's pretty good because we have Crown prosecutors. That's all they deal with is sexual assault. I don't know what it is in the rest of the country, but they are specialized in that and they volunteer to do that. Like they choose to do that job. And if they get burnt out, then they leave. A lot of them do. But and the ones that I know in Montreal are fantastic at their job. I think part of the problem is an ignorance about the justice system. I think we tend to see a lot of stuff on TV where, you know, in one hour show, the woman is ripped to bits on the witness stand. That's not the reality of cases like this. I've seen women have good experiences in court. I've seen women have bad experiences. Some of the ones, like, for instance, women now can testify in another room by video. They don't have to face their aggressor in court. I think the defense lawyers, you know, they have to be able to question the person enough that their client gets a fair trial, but they're not allowed to go into their past, you know, the rape shield law and so on. So I think we just have to keep pushing for improvements there. I think, you know, educating the police, you know, they have sexual assault squads that are specially trained in dealing with these, with these events. You know, I think it's a constant thing. And we also have something in Quebec called CAVAC, which is like victim support. So there's always women that accompany you to court. They don't really have legal standing, so they can't stand up and object or ask for a publication ban. In the Magnotta trial, the victim's family had that and had a lawyer, so maybe that's something that they could do. I don't know how that would be paid for. But I think, you know, I think the main thing is to have support from the minute it happens right up until you go through the court system. And we need to educate people about what that system is going to be like or what that process is going to be like. And if you have a crappy experience, report it. You know, like, complain about these cops that didn't treat you properly or whatever. You know, I think things have gotten better, but I think we have still a lot of improvement.
Hi, thanks. I'm just curious if your experience of the success of the Bin Rape Never Reported hashtag, like success in that, you know, we didn't have all of these trolls coming along, and obviously I was just amazed by it, and I thought there was a lot of really interesting things that happened because of it. So to me, it was like a very successful piece of that puzzle that was unraveling after the Gomeshi stuff came out. So I'm just curious if that shifted your thinking at all. Like, did you want to do something there and in social media because you couldn't report it in the Gazette, that piece of it that you wanted to report? Was there something about that there was no, like, nothing to latch on to that could really, like, be able to give you a story, and or you just didn't have that list of names? Like, what was it that made you go to social media, and did it change your thinking at all about, well, if there's this part of this story that I just can't get into my coverage, or my editors don't want to let me, or whatever, that maybe then I could use social media in some other way to be able to get it across.
Well, I wasn't covering the Gomeshi story because it was a Toronto story, and Montreal Gazette is very Montreal. So, but everyone was talking about it, of course. So it wasn't a matter of not being able to do a story for the Gazette. Like, we were doing all kinds of sort of side stories about, sexual violence. But honestly, I put zero thought into it. I was just pissed off, and I just wanted to say, you know what? Like, none of us come forward. And I'm sort of like a public person at the Gazette and in Montreal. And I thought, if I can put my name out there and tell my story, maybe other people will do it. And then we can just show the sheer numbers of people and who have been raped and never reported it. And at the same time, support these women that are coming forward and denouncing Gomeshi. I felt they needed support. And that's exactly what happened. So I was really pleased. So it really didn't have anything to do with coverage or not being able to write something. In fact, the paper asked me to write two pieces after that about my experience of being sexually assaulted, but also about the hashtag. Like 5 years ago, they sent us to Hamilton for training on Twitter. And I remember that the girl training us, she was a girl. I call her a girl because she was like 12. And she was talking like this, hashtag RSS, sticky, blah, blah, Twitter. Like, honest to God, I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I had barely mastered email, I think, at that point or whatever. And it was hilarious. It was all these old journalists from the Gazette. And we were just like, oh, my God. Like, if this is the future of journalism, shoot us now. Because none of us could understand what she was talking about. So that was just 5 years ago. So, and eventually, you know, we had to adapt and go, tweet. And so, you know, that was the first time. I mean, I saw during the Magnotta trial, like I was live tweeting during the trial, and a lot of people started following me, which I thought was kind of creepy, but anyway, whatever. But this was the first time I saw the power of it, and it's incredible. And I really think that this government and governments before have destroyed the women's movement in this country, and I think this is the way that we're going to rebuild it, you know, or bring it together or revive it or whatever. You know, I think something has shifted last year. Something, the ground has moved, you know, and I think we have to ride that wave, keep it going.
Yeah, it seems to me too, and many people I speak to, that things have been changing in the last couple of years, and last year in particular. And I'm curious, like, about how it gets framed in the media, if you think that's changed. Like, the term rape culture, people have been talking about, that's been getting more and more in the media. Do you see that happening as well from your point of view, and do you find that to be a useful way?
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, it's because women are running newsrooms now, because it's a lesser paid job. So I think that's why. But also I think because of social media, like, we're seeing what people are doing. Like, you know, this woman that's carrying around her mattress and, I love that story, you know, and probably without social media, we would never hear about it. You know, like, before, our news used to be pretty local, or if there was a big story happening somewhere, we would hear about it. But, like, all these little stories, and the Bill Cosby story, of course, is big, but we hear more and more details about it because of social media. Like, it's so much more democratic. You have so many more voices talking about these issues. So I think it's bigger than, obviously, than mainstream media, thank God, you know. But mainstream media has been forced to follow social media because that's where the chatter is. Like, that's what's trending, you know, so we have to keep up with it. So I think it's good.
So my name's Megan. I'm actually a volunteer with QSASC. This is more of like a comment, I guess, rather than question. It's just something that kind of like sparks my interest, so I'm sure it might others too. So one thing that really aggravates me is that like a lot of the time you'll see like people that do report it. Like, so for instance, it took me 8 years to disclose the fact that I was sexually assaulted when I was 8 years old. And when I did tell the police and my parents and my family, like, there was that initial, like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, like, that happened to you, are you okay? Like, people were interested to begin with, and then, like, court takes a long time, and it's, like, a long process, and people kind of, like, lose interest or lose, like, yeah, I guess I don't want to say lose interest, but, like, they just kind of, like, forget about it. So until, like, that person's actually, like, until court's done, until they're convicted, like, or not. And so I'm interested in, like, finding a way for people to bridge that gap, right, of, like, from, like, initial contact to, like, the end. Like, because people just tend to, like, because court takes forever, like, to find that way to, like, keep, like, the spark alive kind of thing, just in, like, keep talking about it without losing people's interest and that kind of stuff. So that's, like, kind of what I'm, like, trying to find is, like, that bridge. Right. Yeah.
Well, I think social media is extremely helpful for things. Like, there's a woman, because of the hashtag, she started a website called When You're Ready. And all these women and some men have been writing their stories on this website. And she says she's overwhelmed with, like, she has a full-time job, and she just decided to set this up to keep the momentum going. And so I don't know how many stories she's up to now, but it's, you know, it's quite incredible. And there's one in Quebec, too, in French, that came out of the hashtag. So, you know, there's all these places where women can come together. It's kind of like new moms, too, that find each other on the internet and, you know, console each other that they're crappy mothers or whatever, you know, and what have I done? And I wish I had had that when my kids were little. But, you know, like maybe something like that about setting up, I don't know, like what are they called, chat rooms or, see, I don't even know the lingo. You know, using social media to support people who are going through the process, you know, where you could bring everybody together, where you could give each other advice and reassure them and, like, yeah, it does take a long time, you know, and you just have to put your faith in the prosecutor and wait it out. And or maybe we need to start a website that maybe it even exists now, I don't know, about how you describe the process, you know, like just resources for people, or I don't know if you can bring people together.
My question is, we know that about 90% of sexual assaults and rapes go unreported, but the ones that are reported, even they don't lead to any kind of conviction, sometimes don't even lead to going into the courtroom, like you were saying before. And as a criminal justice reporter, I was wondering if you've seen any kind of patterns with why this happens, like as in patterns with the police who are dealing with it, the investigators, or patterns with just the system itself or the victims, or the, like, if you see any pattern as to why this is such a big issue.
Well, it's hard to see any pattern or anything because it's all so confidential. You know, we don't... The police won't talk to us about what they're doing. It's very hard to get statistics. Now under the Harper government, it's going to be even harder to get any statistics. I think the last really good study that was done was in 1998. Wasn't it Holly Johnson? 93. Right. So, I mean, that was... prior to the internet, it'd be really interesting to see up-to-date statistics on this, you know, about how many and so on. So I, you know what, I don't really have a handle on it at all. I've applied for a fellowship from the Atkinson Foundation. Hopefully in September I will be doing in-depth research and articles that will appear in the Toronto Star on sexual assault in Canada and what is going on in this country. Hopefully I'll be able, yeah, so I'll have all the answers in a year. But I specifically want to look at like in terms of public policy, what we should be doing in education and what we should be doing in the justice system. Because I don't know the answers. I think a lot of the, you know, I think it's obvious that a lot of women don't report because fear of messing up their families, fear of losing their financial support, fear of losing their jobs, fear of losing their friends. you know, it takes a lot to do that. It's not the same as charging a stranger. I mean, I went through all kinds of grief with my family for years. It's fine now, it's good, but it took a lot of educating for them to get what I was doing, you know? Because they thought I was making an old man's life really bad, really hard. I said, oh, that's nice. I was three.
It's Erin from Octiva again. One of the things that I thought was amazing about the Been Raped, Never Reported hashtag is the volume of response that you got. And it's right in the hashtag, Been Raped, Never Reported. And it was around, you know, you guys responded to providing support to the women that were coming forward in the context of Gian Gomeshi. But I think what's really telling and what I find, you know, and you're a justice reporter, so of course your focus is that. But if 90% aren't going to the justice system, we keep harping on it, and maybe it can be fixed. I don't know. I think it's designed in a particular way to represent the state, not the individual. That is always going to play against sexual assault survivors going through the system. But we aren't spending enough time as a society looking at what services are available that support individuals, women, men, gender nonconforming folks. Conforming folks to come forward and get support, not necessarily to the criminal justice system. We know it's severely under-resourced. And to me, the next opportunity is, if there's this awareness, how can we support those organizations to do their work better? And I love Kathleen Wynne's prioritization of this issue, but when we look at the breakdown of what's being looked at, it's public education, it's education in the curriculum, and then criminal justice system, policing, and there is stuff around campuses. And there's responses, survivor support within a healthcare system. But so far in that action plan framework, there's nothing about support for the 90% that aren't going to the criminal justice system.
Yeah, that's interesting. There was a huge study done, I think, in 2012 or 2014. No, 2012, where they found that the biggest engine of change for all of this is an independent women's movement. Not the wealth of nations, not politicians, not, there was something else. So I think after the Polytechnique in 1989, you guys are probably too young to remember that too, but all the women that were shot at the University of Montreal, Mark Lepine said he lined them up and he shot them because they were feminists. He said that. So, but I remember in the wake of that, you know, for a brief moment, the women's movement rose up and we were furious that these women were killed because of their gender and because they were feminists. But most, I think it's just not even feminists, just women. And then there was such a backlash after that that it shut it down. We weren't allowed to use the F word anymore. No more feminism. And I think we all retreated into our little cubby holes. And there was this generation that was loath to say they were feminists, you know, like it was a bad thing to be a feminist. It was like if you said you were a feminist, that boys wouldn't like you. You know, you'd never have a boyfriend. And I really think for the past 25 years since Polytechnique, we've been quiet. And somehow Gomeshi hit a nerve and it's exploded. And I think that's a really great thing. And I think that's what we have to cash in on and focus on is rebuilding the women's movement, because Harper has, I mean, it's gone, right? Like, we still in Quebec have this Council for the Status of Women. Here you have, I don't know, the ministry or the department, but they've taken out, and they've taken out equality even in their mandate or something. Like, it's just, I don't even know what they do. But we're completely underfunded now. And so the question is, and how do services that are available, how do you talk to each other? How do you create this network so that we could, the first thing we need to do is like a survey, what is available? You know, what is available and what do we need and how are we going to do it? You know, that doesn't exist right now. But anecdotally, we don't have enough services. It's clear. You just have to talk to any shelter or anybody, and especially since the hashtag. I hate to say it. And that was one of my concerns, was that, okay, I'm putting this out there and it's going crazy, but what are these poor women doing? Like, is anyone getting any support? I was really concerned about that. And both Antonia and I were getting tons of messages from women. I mean, we aren't therapists, you know, we're journalists. I did not know how to handle that. I would refer them to services I knew about, but I had no idea if they were going to get the service if they went there. So that was a big concern of mine, but I never expected it to be in such numbers. And all the service providers in Montreal told me that since the hashtag, they've been overwhelmed. Yeah, so I'm sorry about that. I take full. Now that I have free time, I could do some therapy.
For me, some of the most powerful tweets in that hashtag was when people were saying, there's a lot of people coming out, but there's so many more who are sitting there wondering, should I write something or should I not? Should I start typing or should I not? And maybe it just really hit me because that was my exact position. And it just seems so crazy because I sit in a pretty privileged position. I should be able to, but I couldn't stop thinking, what does this mean? If I put it, I talk about it in other spaces, but here now, and so I just sat there, and kept reading and just kept refreshing that hashtag, but I think what Erin was saying was really important in that, from my position, I see a lot of interest in community accountability models too, where maybe even how we deal with perpetrators could happen outside of the justice system in another way.
Well, I think, first to your first point about being scared to tweet it, my heart was pounding. I was shaking. I was just okay, go. And that was it. I sent it and there was no turning back, and then it just... Like I said, I had, and first Antonia was being contacted by the media, and then it got translated into French, and then I was being contacted by, everybody in Quebec, and it was almost like one of these movies, right, where you just take one wrong step and your whole life changes. So that was that point. And what was your second? Right. For up north, for example. It's horrible for Native women in the Arctic and in Cree villages because, let's say, your uncle is abusing you. Where do you go? You're related to all these people, and there's no housing, and there's no shelter. So what do? You have to stay in the abusive situation, and I think that some of those communities are dealing with, restorative justice. And just for, in my case, for instance... confronting my grandfather was enough. That was enough. I didn't want him to go to jail. And even with Gomeshi, I don't even care if he goes to jail. What I would like him to do is to be a man and stand up and be a human being and say, yes, I did it and it was wrong and I'm sorry. That's all most people want, right? As an apology, an acknowledgement that you did this and it was wrong. We don't necessarily have to lock them up, although... I don't think that they're actually safe until they're dead, but, you worry about other victims. But maybe outing them is enough to make them stop. I don't know. I really don't know. That's a whole other aspect of it, is the research of, what makes these people do this. That's what I'd like to know. What the hell are you thinking, having sex with a 3-year-old? I don't get it. Or masturbating in public. I don't get it. Women don't do that. I don't get it. So that's what I would like to know. I would like to have men come in and explain. I would like them to give a talk like this about why they do what they do.
That was Sue Montgomery's presentation of Been Raped, Never Reported at Carleton University's Sexual Assault Awareness Week earlier in the winter semester of 2015. Montgomery is one of the creators of the Been Raped, Never Reported hashtag, which has prompted thousands of people, mostly women, to share their experience of sexual assault on social media. It sparked a conversation about the normalization of sexual violence and what can be done to stop it. Thanks for listening to Needs No Introduction. We've got lots of other great content on the Rebel Podcast Network, including full-length talks from some of Canada's leading thinkers. Check out rebel.ca/podcast to see our whole collection dating back 10 years. There's lots of great listening, so do some exploring. And stay tuned as we prepare for our 10th anniversary celebrations of the Rebel Podcast Network, starting in June. And if you know of a talk that would be perfect to podcast on Needs No Introduction, get in touch with me at victoria@rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Thanks for listening, and send us your ideas.